You want to jump right into ATOS?
Absolutely, they're outside.
They're outside, so.
Yeah, and if you've seen the performance, I don't know if you looked at your books, but,
Okay.
Page 28, put the page numbers on the left corner, I think they switch them up to keep me on my toes, but, 28 on the left, so they did outperform for the quarter, but as you can see, negative on the year-to-date period. And then across the board, you know, been a challenging environment for hedge funds in general, so. The last quarter, you know, report that I presented in March, they had negative returns in a positive market, so they were somebody we wanted to bring in and discuss that. If you flip to the next page, you can see their year-by-year returns. So they got off to a good start in 09, and 10 was pretty good. They had a tough 11, outperformed in 12, 13, and 14, and then, you know, 15 they underperformed, so.
So we're comparing them to a treasury bill plus 5%.
That's correct, that's correct. And then we're also comparing them against the hedge, this is a hedge fund universe, the HFN.
Index.
So that's other managers that do what they do. Which they do look better versus that, depending on the period, but you can see that that has been negative for 2015, and they did post a little bit of a positive return. When we hired them back, what is this, 08-ish period when we hired them, it was really an offset to fixed income and equities. We expected them to do not as well as equities, but better than bonds, right? And to have a risk closer to bonds. And they've done some of that, but I think it's, you know, a lot of newer people here to get them to explain that and to sort of see where they are in the process. We good? Now we'll bring them in.
Here? Do you have the time? Or?
So what I've decided is I'm going to go to trustee school in Orlando.
Oh, when it's here?
Yeah, which is January, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
So it's closer.
We'll have you sit.
Yeah, some of those then I'll just commute so I can be with family and all, but
they're
over.
Why do am I the only one that hasn't gone to trustee school?
Yeah, I went awfully and now I went to get into some of our money managers' private little seminars to see how they invest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. So, are you going to?
No, I'm not going to do this.
So about 20 minutes for a formal presentation and then 10 minutes for questions.
Great. Thank you very much, everybody. It's our pleasure to be here once again. I think it was 2013, if I recall correctly, that we last saw you. I'm John Stimson. I work on the business development team. Joined by Jim Divins, who's a senior member, one of the most senior members of ATOS, sits on the investment committee. I thought today we'd give you a brief update on the fund you're invested in, the business, and then most importantly, share our outlook on what we see going forward. But obviously, feel free to jump in. Just a little bit of background. I joined about a year ago. I've worked at several other alternative investment management firms. I also worked in state government for 15 years for two governors of Massachusetts. So I've sat in the public seat that you have in the microscope under which you act every day. So it's nice to be back in this environment. Very briefly, ATOS was started back in 2001 by Ann Cassell. She was the chief investment officer at Stanford University Endowment. Ed Michael Klein, who is president of Morgan Stanley's institutional business. Today, Atos manages about $10.2 billion in capital, primarily for institutions. You can see on the bottom left of page 5 how that's broken out. The public sector is a key part of what we do, and we manage capital on behalf of not only city, but municipal and state plans. On the far right, you can see the types of strategies that we build, or our portfolios. Multi-strategy, which is a type of portfolio you're in, is our largest component, our bread and butter. But very much everything we do is customized to our clients' specific parameters. Page 6, you can see our investment platform. On the far left is the commingled accounts. That's the fund you're invested in, which we'll talk about. It is a 1940 Act SEC registered product, so we have to abide by rules and regulations on behalf of the government. And we do have an independent board for this fund as well. But regardless of the implementation strategy, we negotiate fees on our underlying managers as best we can, and other beneficial terms that we pass along to our clients. Page 7 is the team. I just want to emphasize the seniority and stability. We say Atos is a tough place to get into in terms of the vetting process to work. I just went through it a year ago, but it's also a tough place to leave because we like coming to work every day. It's independently owned. We don't have to answer to any public shareholders or other businesses. You can see the years of experience, 10 years on average working at Atos, as well as more than 20 years in terms of the industry. The first 5 are members of the investment committee in the green, of which Jim's a member. And then we have 2 broader teams, investment management and research, as well as operational due diligence that actually goes and does the due diligence on the managers that we then invested in your portfolio. Page 8 is the broader team, 33 people. You can see again how it's broken out into those different teams. We added 2 people last year, myself and Jim Konzelman. I think since we last saw you, we've had 3 people leave, Mike Spass, Susan Liu, and Bridget McKenna. Bridget, most recently, I worked with her on the business development team. Rose knows her very well. But we feel that we are staffed in a very appropriate way, in a very measured way, to suit our clients and the opportunities that we see. Page 9 is just a little bit on our competitive edge. Again, I want to emphasize our independence, the alignment of interest with our clients. We come into work every day as fiduciaries and managing your money, deep capital markets experience, whether it's Jim's background or Ann Cassell's, the ability to think like investors, not just allocators. And then just a specific focus on hedge funds. We don't manage private equity or real estate or anything else to get in the way of our focus. On to the fund. Page 11 is a brief description of the fund you're in. It's our flagship fund, the Capital Growth Portfolio. It's broadly diversified across 25 to 35 hedge funds, 7 to 10 strategies. It's really a low volatility, low beta fund. And when I say beta, I mean, you know, how much does our fund fluctuate with swings in the market, whether bond market or equity market? And Jim can talk a little bit about that. But the goal is really to create a consistent pattern of returns over the full business cycle. So you came in on April 1st, 2008, initially $4 million. You had additional contribution of $3 million, and you can see your ending balance net of all fees as of June 30, 7.9. The performance on the next page, if you start at the far right at the top, since inception, your performance is 2.54% with volatility, which is measured by standard deviation, of about 4.6%. So if you go down those 2 columns, say to the MSCI ACWI, which is a global equity index that we use to benchmark, they returned 3.37 during that time period with a volatility of 18%. So we're capturing about 70% of that return with 25% less risk, which is what we really intended to do, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But we're never going to outperform an equity benchmark, especially during a bull market, which since you came in, but we're trying to get steady, consistent returns with much less volatility. And then on the bottom, the HFRI FOF is fund of funds. conservative index, you can see how we performed on a 1-3-5-year basis since inception. So we've actually outperformed in each of our peers in each of those timeframes.
Do you have a return for July?
Positive 1.31.
Uh-huh.
So year-to-date brings us to a minus 0.654.
The next page, we tried to show this relative to our peers. So the green area that's shaded, that's actually the excess return above the benchmark, the HFRI, that your fund created on a rolling three-year basis. The reason we do a rolling basis is you can actually see the ups and downs rather than just one point in time. And on the far right, the blue is the cumulative outperformance of your fund above our peers, the HFRI. So just to put it in context. I think one of the reasons we've been able to do what we've done is, you mentioned a very low beta. So this shows you at the very top a zero correlation to the Barclays Ag, which is a fixed income index, and then a very low 0.2 beta, again, at 0 to 1 in terms of the scale. So if you look at the exposure to the market, measured by net exposure, the maroon line at the bottom is very low, it's about 35%. And that translates into the next page, which is the up-down capture ratio. And I think this is the most important page in terms of understanding how this graph fits into your broader portfolio. If you look at all the down months when the MSCI had a negative month over this period of time, and on average, how did it do? It was down 3.84. How did we do in those same months on average? We were down 63 basis points, very close to our peers, down 64. So we captured about 16% of the down performance. And I kind of look at hedge funds as a car with brakes. You know, when you're going uphill, you don't need brakes. But when markets turn, you're going downhill, you need some way to help immunize that fall compared to the equity markets. It's certainly not 100%, we wish it was, but it does provide you some protection, a way to diversify your traditional equity exposure. And then you can see how we've done in all months on the far right. So again, just to put it in context.
Can you back up a little bit and just maybe talk about what a hedge fund is?
Sure.
And then what a hedge fund is versus like a fund of funds, which is what this is. So just,
sure.
You know, a little bit of a...
Yeah, again, a little bit of a context. So, you know, if you ask 100 people what a hedge fund is, you probably get 100 different answers. But I've always looked at it this way, and believe me, I was a government like yourself and went into the industry. The best way to understand it is if you have a traditional portfolio, and I mean traditional stocks, bonds, and commodities, through Fidelity or Vanguard, you know, they own the stocks, they own the bonds, they own the commodities, and you hope the price goes up. Every night you go to bed, you hope the markets will be up the next morning. Hedge funds have an ability to make money, not only when the market goes up, but when markets go down, because they can short these instruments. And as a result, you increase your chances of being right, either when they go up or when they go down. The term hedge, you hedge yourself. Now, there's a cost to that, obviously, and you see on the far left here, okay, we're not participating in the rising market, okay, because there's a cost to hedging, but we are preserving capital because we can short. So when markets go down, you know, we hope to preserve some capital during those down markets. It's very tough one month to the next, but if you look over a complete business cycle, I think they've done a good job in offsetting some of those down markets. So when you think of hedge funds, they're investing in the same stocks, bonds, and commodities that Vanguard and Fidelity are, but they're just able to short some of these instruments, whereas the Fidelities cannot do that in their mutual funds. Hedge fund of funds. There are thousands of hedge funds out there, probably 5,000 if not more. A fund of funds, our job is to go and perform due diligence and find the best ones that we can and put them in a portfolio for you to invest in. So you're getting diversification over 35 to 40 of them, rather than you going out and doing the due diligence yourself on those thousands that you don't have the staff. So we really are your eyes and ears with respect to finding those that we think to provide the best returns at the lowest risk. Jim, I don't know if there's anything else I missed on that.
No, but if you go back to page 12, just kind of illustrated in how we present this is John is always positive, so he's pointing out the outperformance in those over the years on the right side of the 2 to 3, 5 years since inception. The MSCI Global Equity Index, you can think of that's kind of a pond the hedge funds are fishing. It's kind of international, mostly U.S., but a lot of international also. So we compare on that. If their sensitivity to that is about 20 to 30%, if they outperform 20 to 30% of that number, the hedge funds are doing the job. It's worth it to invest in them. If they're not, you wonder what are we getting, what are we paying for? That the comparison to the fund of funds, the HFRI, is are we doing our job picking the correct hedge funds versus our competitors or peers or other places can do it? So are hedge funds doing it and are we doing it for you, or the value add? And over those periods we have, it's only in the most recent, kind of really starting about a year ago, where the performance is out of character, and there are reasons for that, and that's what I'll go into. So as I said, the year, 1 year number and the year-to-date number is negative. After the July number of positive 131, we're just under flat, so slightly negative, coming back out of a bad period. The bad period is really focused in starting really August of last year, the third quarter, and then really the first quarter of this year. And they actually two different things going on there. As John said, hedge funds are trying to protect from the downside, but trying to be hedged, but also take advantage of folks on the long side who can't be as flexible as that. So last August, the markets kind of moved down dramatically, and that was a result of a couple of different things. People were concerned about global growth in the economy. China had gone kind of almost crazy, inflating its market and bringing it down. And then, if you remember, people were talking about, will the Federal Reserve raise interest rates? Is there too much, is there inflation, and that will slow down the economy, and that will affect on companies' earnings at all. Well, that came all together in August, and it was a bit of a sentimental, just get risk, just get out of the market. When that happens, it's actually good for hedge funds, because they get marked down a little bit in those periods. But a lot of those flows in and out of mutual funds and other things causes the baby out the bathwater effect. The company is actually good, but the price has dropped because everyone's selling. It's good for hedge funds to come in and kind of eat their lunch, so to speak. And we saw that in the fourth quarter, October through December, where they actually gained back. So those graphs further on where you have the outperformance kind of coming down and then going back up. So they got back in character. They kind of saw an opportunity and jumped in. That changed dramatically the end of December and into the first quarter, where you had almost like a very fast encapsulation of the last couple of years. You went back to worrying about growth. The Chinese did something just bizarre where the market dropped. They put in regulations to stop people from selling. That's never a good idea. They took those regulations off. The market dropped again. They were down 23% in January. Now, what do we care about the Chinese market if we have any exposure? It's very small, but it had a knock-on effect with confidence around the world, and there was a sell-off globally on markets in general. When it's that severe, you have not only the swings in out of mutual funds, but you also have other hedge funds, kind of competitors and peers of our folks, doing the same thing. And they might be in similar names, so they'll sell or get out of positions to play defense. So they sell their longs, those go down. They have to cover what they're short, and they actually force those prices up. So out of character behavior of our portfolio and our managers is that they lost money on the longs, but usually when that happens, they'll make money on the shorts, but they lost on the shorts also. It's kind of a very kind of bizarre out of character thing. It happens maybe once or twice every 7 or 8 years where the hedge fund peers kind of go out of business, or someone's taking too much risk and has a loss and has to do this, it affects everyone else. It's a good opportunity going forward, but the hedge funds that we like, the fundamental folks who are trying to hedge, they do play a little bit more defense so that they don't come back as fast. And what happens, it takes 1 or 2 quarters to get back to making money, and that's where we are now. So it took through, say, March and April, and into May before they started actually making money from those similar positions. You can see a position go like VIX and then back up. So they're back to where they were and kind of making money again. Now, part of this is that in February, the Federal Reserve Chairman made the comment in testimony in Congress saying that, don't worry, we're not going to raise the interest rates anymore anytime soon. So that took some worry out of it. This is at the same time that the payrolls were not growing as fast as she wanted at all. So that took some worry out of the market and was back to the races. So where you lost money originally wasn't things where you had made money in the last couple of years, so you lost it very quickly. And then when you started making money again, end of April, beginning to May, into June, it were the same areas, sometimes different companies, but in healthcare, in technology, in energy, in more and back. When you have moves like this, you have a lot of winners and losers in the individual company's development, but if you can get that right, you'll be fine. So that's what we want the hedge fund managers to do, make money out of the individuals, not trying to market time it. So when we put together the portfolio to choose the managers, these 35 managers, you get enough diversification, and you want folks who will survive that kind of environment. As I said, it's happened, you know, several times in the past. You really can't predict when, but we want someone who can survive that so that we start making money on the other side. So that's what's been going on really in the last year, starting August last year, but really it was the first quarter phenomenon. It's not a hurricane, but it's like a little tornado that comes through, clears out some people, actually clears out some of the competition, and you get back to making money, which we did in June and now in July. The one bump in the road at the end of June was when the UK voted to leave the EU. That was very disruptive because a lot of people didn't expect it. And they don't really know what the effects will be. So markets in general, any uncertainty, things come off. To a certain respect, that's not bad for hedge funds, and most of our hedge funds are now seeing that as opportunity. We're going, we get bites at apples we like at better prices, both long and short. With the exception of people who are a little bit more exposed to Europe and, strangely, Japan, because the UK's currency came down, the Japanese currency went up, that's bad for Japan, the equity market came down. So we had a little exposure to that at the end of June, but even so had a good positive quarter. And that kind of volatility, that is not a complete disruption, is actually good for hedge funds because it shakes people out of the positions they have, in some cases for non-economic reasons, or for risk management reasons, opposed to really opposite to how they feel about the actual fundamentals of those companies.
You can see on page 16 is a pie chart of the portfolio. So on the top left are the hedge fund strategies you're invested in. These are pretty much the main sub-strategies, the largest being long-short equity or equity hedged as 34%, and event-driven. When we say event-driven, meaning a specific corporate event, a merger, an acquisition, a spin-off, a share buyback, our hedge funds are able to invest in those situations. And you can see how it's changed over time. So we do have a top-down view on where we think the opportunities are over the next 6 to 12 months and try to choose managers in those strategies that we think are favorable. You can see the complete list of managers on page 17 by strategy. But it is diversified not only across strategy but geography, which is why we compare it to a global index, but primarily North America.
Are there certain strategies that you don't invest in?
We don't say we don't invest. We shy away from them for different reasons. So we don't have a lot of global macro. We've had a little bit in the past, but because our sensitivity to markets are so low to begin with, we don't need them to just get our correlations down. If we want to use them, we use them because we think the return is there. So in the past, we've used a little bit of them. And we don't use, say, a long-short equity manager who's trying to market time and swings his portfolio dramatically long and short, trying to figure out these changes in sentiment in the market. We think that's very, very difficult. We think if it's difficult for the managers, it's difficult for us to choose the good managers there. So again, if we have a diversified portfolio, we can avoid having to swing at that pitch, we do.
And then, what's your sort of turnover on the number of managers? What have you maybe fired recently and then gone into?
The turnover is about 10 to 15% of the names every year. And that's for, in some cases, they retire. Some cases, there's too much turnover in their personnel where the talent is changing. In some cases, we think their ability in the market is fading away. So recent changes, At the same time, we're doing dollar changes on the sizes of the manager. So this past year, starting about a year or so ago, when we thought that, say, in healthcare or technology, it really had been a great period of time, well, let's take some money off the table. There's a specific technology manager. He did okay, but then he had a very kind of difficult period. He had personnel turnover. He had what I call too many swinging strikes, where he was wrong in names. And his risk management through this volatile period was not too good. We said, that's it. You don't work in the portfolio anymore because your volatility is too much and your correlations to the market's going up. And we don't think that's going to change going forward because the people you have are different. So you exit him. So it's the idea is that if everything is okay, we don't want to have to force changes just to do it. For marketing purposes, it looks like we're doing something. But it's a natural turnover, about 10 to 15.
Were there any managers that particularly caused the losses in the last couple of quarters?
There was an energy manager who really was hurt at the end of the year in the first quarter. But he runs very, very, if you just look at his portfolio on a dollar basis, his market exposure is very low. But he was swinging like crazy on the performance. So what's going on? Other hedge fund managers were getting out of his position, kind of forcing those prices around. And when we looked at those relationships between the companies he was long and companies he was short, we said, this makes no sense at all. We actually added to him after the downdraft and kind of, in effect, doubled up on him. He's a smaller manager. He's a little bit more volatile, so he's never going to be that big in the portfolio. We can't afford too much risk in there. But it made no sense to us, the behavior. And what he's doing is mostly U.S., petroleum complex, so he'd be long exploration and drilling companies in this basin versus that basin. So maybe long in northern Texas and in Oklahoma and short west Texas and Pennsylvania, and then within even the tighter areas, because he can see the information coming out of those drilling sites every week. Legally, they have to report it. That performance is very bizarre. So we doubled down, and what he's made money on, the recovery of those names relative to each other. He's also made good money in the second quarter because he noticed that, you know, all the, you know, hydraulic fracturing, the fracking going on, with the price of oil down, a lot of drills were closing down. And they said, for the people who supply sand to shove down the hole, that's not going to be good. The market's going away. So people have sold those off. But he noticed that the technology of the people who continue to drill, they're actually using 3 or 4 times the amount of sand they did 2 years ago. That's going to be a surprise when people see the numbers, and that's what happened. So that's what we want him to do, to kind of figure out those kind of micro little things for the companies and put his portfolio together where he can survive the moves. He's going to be always more volatile because the energy field is more volatile. But it's a similar thing we want the technology guys to do. But he hurt us in the first quarter and then helped us in the second quarter. If we thought that he was losing his analyst or emotionally he couldn't handle the volatility, we would get out of him because the prospect going forward for him to do it again are lower. And that's what we did with that one technology manager.
You know, it might be helpful, page 21. It kind of goes back to your question of the role of a hedge fund in a portfolio, and we've gotten these questions lately, you know, the why now, why hedge funds now? You've obviously been invested since 2008. We talked about how hedge funds are looking to add lower correlation to your broader portfolio to help provide some hedging, so when markets do go down, you can help preserve capital, or to just have more flexibility in how they invest in stocks, bonds, and commodities through their ability to short it, or go to cash when they don't see an opportunity. The person at Vanguard or Fidelity has to be fully invested to a benchmark all the time. So we have more levers to pull, but on page 22, you can see we tried to show some charts here, one on the volatility going back in time, and one on correlation, which we think is favorable to hedge fund strategies now. You know, correlations, if you remember back in 2011, 2009, really shot up for macro events going on, all the events in Europe, you know, the recession, housing. It was very hard to pick winners and losers. Central bank activity, which distorted asset values, certainly played a role too. Now that we're moving away from that and there's more clarity, correlations have come down. So it's a better environment to actually pick stocks. Where you can go long the winners and short, those that you think are bad business models. And volatility has come down as well, you know, less panic, less fear in the market, which again can distort asset levels. So we actually think now it is a good time to be in the market. Page 24 probably sums it up. You can see when you came in April 2008, and what's happened, the top line is the equity markets, and the bottom line is fixed income, and both are at a high. Fixed income, that's showing the yields, which is an inverse correlation to price. So low yields mean the price is higher. But the reality is this. You've made a lot of money in your equities, conceivably you've done well in your fixed income, but the last 5 or 6 years really, we feel this has been an outlier if you look historically. And I think mathematically no one expects the same level of appreciation in stocks and bonds to continue over the next 5 years. So to have some, to take some chips off the table, so to speak, in your equity or even your fixed income, to have it in hedge funds where, again, very low correlation of fixed income or equity can help diversify the portfolio against, you know, volatility, certainly in your equity, and just the low yields of fixed income. I mean, you obviously have a discount rate that you're trying to hit to fund your liabilities. And you hear this a lot from public plans saying, well, how am I going to get a 7% return to fund this when the 10-year treasury is at 150?
And don't promise people 7%.
I said, yeah, not us necessarily, but generally. And you know, that's a real problem. And so if you can't hit that, then you either have to add more money into your pensions, obviously, which has political ramifications and budgetary constraints that you have. So we feel that this is one piece of the puzzle that may help, in the aggregate, get you closer to your investment goals, especially in protecting in the downside. I think Warren Buffett said it best, the best way to make money is not to lose it. You know, if you have $100 and you're down 50%, you have to be up 100% the next year just to get back to where you were. But if we can help you not be down 50, but be down 25, you know, it's a quicker round trip. And that's what we did in 2008. Equities were off anywhere from 30 to 50%. We were down, I think, 17. Well, being down 17 is not a great number, but I think relative to where the other markets were, it was a quicker path back to break even and then some. So
you can promise us 7%.
Oh, yeah.
Every day.
You wouldn't believe me. But it comes down to, you know, maybe the traditional markets are at a level where the prospective return is not great for history because they run so far. But then is the opportunity set within the different hedge fund strategies enough to make it worth it? We think so. One is because we've been through this kind of this wave. We're coming out of the other side, and we've cleared out some other hedge funds who are competing. And then on the general environment, it hasn't changed that much from a year or so ago, where the U.S. is growing but kind of slower than we'd like. You've put off interest rate rises for a while. There should be a little, some what I call good volatility, medium-sized volatility in the markets going into the elections and all, and past that. You have things that have changed over time, like the oil price coming down, the currency markets being changed, the fact that both in Europe, the UK, and Japan, they're still kind of pushing on the string, pushing money into the system. That creates winners and losers on individual securities, individual companies, and individual asset classes. When that happens, and you have less correlation within those, so you know, prices, people look at the specific developments of a company or a bond, that's good for hedge funds, and they get back to making money without taking market risk. So we've had this disruption, but the overall environment is similar at this part of the cycle, and the way companies our earnings are coming in, there are things to be, basically there's an opportunity set to pick up if you've structured your portfolio correctly.
Are there any either questions related just to what we do, or again the opportunity set going forward, or the market? Certainly, whether it was China, Brexit, oil, we have an election coming up. You know, there's a lot of noise out there, and I think our managers are trying to sift through that to find opportunities globally where they can. certainly we started off the year and equity markets were very rough, and we all remember that. And after Brexit, you know, steep drop, but then a steep rebound. And I think no one here at the table would have expected that we'd now be at all-time high, just from a few weeks ago. So there's just a lot of events out there that, you know, whether the Fed raises or keeps interest rates the same, that are on people's minds. And I think we're speaking directly to our managers to stay on top of that and position the portfolio where, truthfully, we're more agnostic of what happens and just trying to find great opportunities at the stock and bond levels and not get caught up with the noise on a macro level.
I'm all about fees, so let's go to page 18.
Okay. So we laid out on 18 the terms, the fees and terms. So the management fee that you're paying us is 75 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
That is in addition to underlying fee of the managers in which we invest. I mentioned earlier that we do our best to push them on fee discounts, so the weighted average underlying fee.
Yeah, it's not the 2%.
It's not the 2 and 20 that you hear. It's probably 1.4 and 18 thereabouts. This fee is actually discounted because of a broader relationship. We see normally it's I think 1 and 10.
It's 1 and 10.
We
came down last year.
Yeah, we offered 75. We treat all the clients with Siegel in the aggregate, so we're able to do that. The hurdle rate, 3-month T-bills, we do have a high watermark for performance.
There's more and more sensitivity across the industry at the hedge fund level and at the fund-to-fund level, and we have to work with that and kind of to a certain extent.
I'm just curious, how do you figure out the incentive piece?
Well, the incentive
is when you're really up, you hit 10%, but when it's down, you wait until the next time it goes up?
No, that doesn't kick in.
3 months?
No, it's our accountant wants to do it correctly, so he accrues it every 3 months, and he'll take it, but it basically, we have to pay it back with the next, you know, basically there's a high water where we might make it in one quarter, and then we're down the following quarter, we have to give it back. So by the end of the year, you take it out, and then if you're down that year, we get nothing. So in the most recent period, we got nothing. But the idea is that it's a sign that, okay, we actually have to be interested in what's going on in the portfolio on a daily basis. And if we think the portfolio isn't appropriate going forward, we should change it. So kind of puts discipline around our rationale for doing things and kind of puts that on the table and say, okay, that's what we do. So, and the 3-month T-bill, when we started the business, T-bills were 5%. So it's much lower now, but the overall nominal returns of almost all asset classes are lower because of it.
Well, just, I realize that you have a very competitive hedge fund fee here. So, you can take my comments with that. I realize it's a competitive fee, but you know, I think that just a message you want to take to the powers that be is that we still think the fees are high, and we think that a incentive fee and a hurdle rate of the 3-month T-bill is a little bit crazy, and that, you know, that hurdle rate, yes, it was 5%, and that's sort of what we thought of you making above 5%, then maybe you should get an incentive fee, but making more than maybe 0.5% seems a little bit, you know, out of line with what we're looking at. And so, given that your fees are, but the whole industry, we feel like, in the hedge fund industry, and that's from the consulting world and from the public fund world, is that they seem rather high for a 2% return over since inception.
Yeah, certainly we'll communicate that to Ann and Michael. And look, you know, it is a fee-laden business. You know, we're not going to tell you that it isn't. We show the performance net, you know, and our managers do as well. But we do feel if you believe in active money management, okay, and some people don't. Some people think you should just go buy an ETF or an index and pay 10 basis points, and then you would have done terrific in the last 6 years. The 60-40 equity bonds did amazingly well. But I don't think anybody expects that track record to continue going forward. So if you believe in active management and it's traditional long-only managers and hedge, personally sleep better at night knowing that my hedge manager has more levers to pull to navigate markets by being able to short those businesses that he thinks, you know, are in declining industries or don't have good fidelity, versus the person at Fidelity who has to be invested in Apple and Cisco and Amazon and all these others, because that's what the benchmark says. Then those fees, I think, are really high, because I just don't think a lot of alpha there. But I do think there's more flexibility in with the hedge model. Not perfect by any means. We'd love to be able to come here and say that our performance was double what we've given you since inception. And the burden is on us in the industry to show that we're earning those fees. And again, I sat in your seat, and I know you have to report, okay, to the powers that be here, whether it's the electorate or the media, the local newspaper, you know, the mayor. So we've appreciated your support and, you know, hope to grow this, you know, performance over time, but certainly sensitive to the fees and the other issues that you're dealing with.
Does anyone else have any questions? Cool. Well, thank you for coming in and
appreciate it.
Can we look for that 7%?
Yes.
Thank you. You look hard.
Yeah.
And she'll make sure. She'll call us.
And the fee's going down.
And the fee's going down.
Yeah, absolutely. The headline point is that if you buy U.S. Treasuries, which that still have a positive yield, but you hedge them back to yen, you get a negative yield. It's very difficult for folks.
I'll prepare a minimum guarantee fee.
And I'll happily give it to the head of our firm. That sounds good.
Trust me, if I can do that, then I'm going to my personal advisor.
Thank you all.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for taking care. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you.
All right, Rose.
Okay, so we're going to go over the June performance. And we always like to look at the markets to see what the markets did in June, and then we'll look at your specific performance. So we'll move to page one, which is under tab one. The MSCI World was up 1% for the quarter, which was negative through March, so up 0.66% year-to-date. The Russell 3000, which is small cap, mid cap, and large cap U.S. stocks, was up 2.63% for the quarter, up 3.62% year-to-date. The MSCI EAFE, which is developed international equities, was down for the quarter, and that was mostly attributed to June and Brexit and all the activity there. They were doing fairly well through May, and then June, with all of that activity, you had the negative quarter and negative year-to-date. You could see emerging markets finally seeing some returns there. Everybody said, Rose, you told us to invest in emerging markets. What a stupid idea. We had negative returns for a while, and you're finally seeing positive outcome in that asset class, up 6% year-to-date. Bonds. Everybody sort of, when Brexit happened, when there's a lot of activities, people flee to bonds. So even though interest rates are so low, people are fleeing to safety. And we'll show you the move in the yield curve. And so bonds had a strong quarter. And if you look, 5.31% for the ag, outperforming all the equity markets, except for emerging markets there. And non-U.S. Bonds, is what we call this the WGBI, which is non-U.S. bonds, up 4% for the year-to-date period, up 13%. Now, your bond manager has a mix of everything. So your bond manager has U.S. bonds, has international bonds, has some high-yield bonds in there. So they've done a really good job of keeping a good mix and getting into the bond market that's performing well. Commodities, which you don't really have in your portfolio, finally did have a recovery, up 11% year-to-date, but if you look at all those negatives across the board, they still have a long way to go. And that's mostly oil and, you know, precious metals is what the base of that is. Real estate, which you've had, we've increased real estate here. It's done very well for you. You can see a really great performer. If you look at the 10-year number, you know, in line with U.S. stocks, the real estate market has been over the last 10 years. private equity, which we don't have here, it's been doing very well. And then hedge funds, very challenging market, you heard that from them, negative year to date. Luckily, you know, we had another positive time in July, and you can see the 10-year return there. We keep all the same charts in here. I hope you got invited to the webinars that we have. If you didn't get invited to our webinars, make sure I have your email address, and I'll make sure you're added so you get to our webinars, and you can talk to our research group directly. I don't go over all these pages because it'd be too much. But if you move to page 6, we just like to talk about the S&P 500. You hear that on the news all the time, so like to talk about the S&P. S&P was up for the quarter at 2%, year-to-date 3.8, and then through this morning, year-to-date through Friday's close, the S&P was up 6.8%. So you could see a lot of recovery there in July. The S&P was up 3.6 in July, and then up about a half a percent already in August. You know, seeing some recovery there. You can see growth in value. There's been a large dispersion there. You can see for the quarter, the Russell 1000 value is up 4 versus the growth up only 0.6. And then you can see on the small cap side, value outperformed growth on the small cap side, not as much. And then we'll look at the bond market, which is pages 10 and 11. And you can see those returns across the board. Long governments, you can see up 14% for the year-to-date period. Gov credit up 6% year-to-date. The high yield up 9% year-to-date. So very strong returns. And you'll see on page 11 the yield curve. So the yield curve as of 3/31 was that dotted green line. And the yield curve actually shifted down. So as interest rates are down, bonds do better, and that's where you sort of see your return in the bond market. Just the noteworthy developments we like to put in the back. I'm not going to go over them, but just pages 18 and 19, we always put in some noteworthy developments. Most of them are about Brexit. So the top page there is U.S. government bond yields post-Brexit, so you can sort of see the effect there. And then we talk about dividends for technology sector on the rise. A lot of people, as there's uncertainty, will flee to either bonds or they'll flee to income-generating stocks. So that's the part there. The impact of Brexit on other advanced economies there. And then artificial intelligence. There's been a lot of economist articles on artificial intelligence, how that's going to affect the job market, how that's going to affect. And so we put a little quick piece in there about that. Now we'll move on to your portfolio specifically. So if you look on page 21, as of the end of the quarter, you had $122,065,294. And that was up from the prior quarter of $119 million. You can, and we'll move to page 24, which gives you your breakdown versus your target versus your actual. So in your guidelines, you have these targets here on the left. This is where your money's supposed to be. 14% in large cap, 6% in small cap, 22% international, 32% fixed, 12.5% real estate, 13.5% alternatives, 0% cash. And so we just check every quarter to make sure you're in your ranges and on your target. So large cap, you're at 14.3, so right on there. Small cap, you're at target 6, you're at 7.4, so pretty close there. International target's 22, you're at 19. Your fixed target's 32, you're at 32. Real estate, you're at 12.5. This target, you're at 12.5. And then alternatives, you're a little under there by about 2%, but 13 versus 12, so not a big deal. And then cash. And so that's something we would always talk to Alicia about, the cash position there. We'd like to keep that under 1% if we can. And usually this is more of a residual cash position. I don't know if you've used a lot of this or if you know, but we like to keep that invested. And Alicia always reaches out to me to tell me she needs to invest the money or she needs more money. So she keeps a pretty good eye on that. The next page is your total fund performance on page 25. So you did underperform slightly for the quarter, 1% versus 1.67%, and for the year-to-date period. And then you had a negative one-year return, and a lot of that was from the March period. It's been a very volatile period, under 0.73% versus the benchmark of 1.91. And then your three-year, your five-year, your 7 years right on the your index, and the 10-year, and then since inception, you've outperformed. And then if you look at your fiscal periods, page 26, so you can see this is your fiscal years, what your actuary uses. And their returns are a little bit different than ours. They do a little bit different calculation. But you can see in 06, you sort of lagged slightly. In 07, you outperformed. 08 was the tough negative markets, and you underperformed in 08. You outperformed in 9 and 10, in line in 11, underperformed slightly in 12, outperformed in 13, basically in line in 14, and then underperform there in 15. And then the next page is calendar versus your fiscal year. So you can see the calendar return there. And then we'll move to page 28 and go through each of your individual managers. You have Wedge Capital, underperformed for the quarter, which trailed out for the year, but you can see they're outperforming on the three-year, under a little bit on the five-year, outperforming on the seven-year, and outperforming since inception. I will tell you they had a strong July. They were up 4% in July, which would take their year-to-date return up to about 6%. So happy to see that kind of return in July. Wellington underperformed. Wellington had been a manager that we've gone back and forth with, you know, since they were hired. They had a tough time when they first came on board, and then they were doing better, and then they've had a tough year-to-date period there. But they were up also 4% in July, 4.4%. So year-to-date, they are now positive, 3.8% or so. Siegel Bryant Hamill. Underperformed for the quarter, outperformed for the year-to-date, outperformed on the one-year, in line there on the three-year and the five-year, and then really in line since inception. Small cap is a really tough space to find a consistent manager. Small cap stocks are very volatile, so it's a tough sort of space there. Templeton. Had a really tough quarter and year-to-date. Brexit had a lot to do with that. And you can see that put their one-year return off, three-year and five-year, it trails out. Endpoint is so, and when I say endpoint, I mean if you have a really bad quarter, it makes your three, five-year, and all your other things look bad when it may be not as bad as it looks if we look on the year-to-year. 7 year underperforming, outperforming on the 10 year, and outperforming since inception. Acadian doing well, outperforming for the quarter, outperforming year to date, under a little bit on the 1 year, and the 3 year outperforming since inception. And emerging markets came back strong in July too. I don't have their July return, but I know that they've been doing well. Pyramids is your bond manager. Like I said, they're very diversified. You can see up 6%. Year-to-date, great return, outperforming over all periods. Double Line under a little bit for the quarter and year-to-date period. They got off to a sort of a rocky start. You just hired them in 15, in line since inception. I don't think you have anything to worry about there, but it's, you know, a newer manager for you. UBS is one of the top three real estate core managers in the country. They're always going to be a little bit under the benchmark, and you can see that here. The one-year number, we'd like that to be stronger, but if you look at over the longer period of time, they're outperforming since inception on the 10-year. You're basically in line on the 7-year. Wellington, you hired to replace PIMCO. Glad to see that there. They had a tough, you know, just 1 month here, you know, a little bit negative, but they were up 4% for the month of July. So that's really good. That's where, you know, we want them to be. And then Atos, you heard from today, outperforming for the quarter, under over all the other periods except for the 7 year period and since inception. And then you have your cash account there, which is pretty much.
If you move to page 30, this is your real estate managers. You have a real estate core manager, which is invests in just income properties, and then you have value add managers, and they are measured on a different basis, on an IRR basis, as they take your money and give your money back. So you can see them here, all of them doing very well. The Long Wharf 5, it's just too new. We had talked about the J-curve effect. You give them money, they have time to invest in the properties, and then it takes them a while to come out of that because they're adding money to the properties, building them up, and so their values don't come up until after a couple of years from when you invest in them. So everything good. They are happy to see, you know, Long Wharf, you know, get the money that you gave them, and off to a good start there. You committed $3 million, they've called down $800,000, so they still have a lot of money to call down for you. And so that is your summary. I'm not recommending any changes. There's managers we're going to keep watching and continue to watch, but you have strong managers. It's just been a tough market. It's been a tough market for everybody. And a lot of the really good managers are the managers that have gotten hurt out there. So we're seeing this in a lot of clients where all your equity managers look terrible for the quarter. They just look terrible. And it's not, you know, I don't think it's a long-term proposition. It's just that the markets have been so all over the board recently. And we're seeing some of that come out in July, but, you know, with the election and everything, you're going to see a few more bumps before we get to the end of the year. So that's basically it for the performance. I have a couple other things with regards to your guidelines. Take any questions regarding the report first.
Is your recommendation just leave everything the way it is with our investments?
Yeah, I don't have any recommendations for changing. I don't think changing in this market is a good thing to do unless you really have a manager whose staff has turned over, whose people are leaving, who, you know, is falling, right, losing assets. None of your managers are losing money. People aren't pulling money from them. They're not losing clients. They're not losing staff. We monitor all these managers for you. We've met with, this past quarter, we met with Acadian again just to do a routine checkup to make sure. We also met with Long Wharf. So no issues there that we would say is of concern. You may want to bring somebody in. You know, you do have some newer people here. I think what Atos did today was helpful. I don't know if you all thought that way. So you might bring in like a Templeton to maybe talk about the Brexit and the international markets at the next meeting. If you know, can spare the 30 minutes for them, I think that would be helpful.
I think so. I mean, Templeton, you know, looks overseas a lot of information there overseas, what's going on. There's a lot of things changing over there now.
Yeah.
So I think that would be helpful to see what they're looking at, to see what they feel like is going on with Brexit and that kind of thing. So I think that would be helpful. And then your guidelines. So I think you received these are the red line versions of the changes that we would like to make. When you went from PIMCO to Wellington, the PIMCO benchmark was the T-bills plus 5.
Right.
When we went to Wellington, our research group in the last 4 or 5 years has decided it's really better to measure these people against a 60-40 benchmark. 60% broad equity market. When I say broad, I mean U.S. and non-U.S. equities, and then 40% broad bond market, U.S. and non-U.S. bonds. Because that's what you want them to outperform, like a 60-40 split over time, not just a T-bill plus 5, which really has been only 5%, right? So we want them to outperform the broad market. So that's the substantive change in here, is that just to outperform that benchmark. And you'll see that on page 2, we changed it from CPI plus 5 to the 60-40 of the Wigbee. Mm-hmm. And that's just to be consistent with what Wellington's now outperforming. The only other change would be this, which we talked about last meeting. I'll pass this down. A
and this is the exact same document I gave you last meeting, which is just the de-risking language, you know, Bernie had the concern about what do we do as we get more and more funded, and the risk of that, and taking risk off the table. So this wouldn't happen right away. It wouldn't be till you were 80% funded, and I think you're only in the 60s, right, maybe now, or 50s?
Upper 50s.
So this wouldn't take effect until you were 80% funded, but it's basically saying, you know, to anybody from the outside who looked in, they can care about risk, they've looked about risk, you have a risk policy. If anybody ever came to you as a board member, said, do you care about risk, are you concerned about risk, this talks about risk, and basically, as we get more funded and we get more money in this plan, that really we understand that the purpose of this plan is just to pay benefits, and just to do, it's not to go reach for high returns, it's just to really pay our obligations. And as we get more and more funded, we're gonna take that risk off the table. And that's what this is. So this would be my proposal, is to have this added to your investment policy. It just would go after, on page two, it would go after where you say investment objectives, and you see CPI plus 4.5, it would be a number 4, and then I put this language in there, just like this. And like I said, I really wouldn't do anything until you get to a high percentage, but you could tell, you know, people ask, you would have this in there. And I think it's a good thing. So that would be, you would just need a vote on that if you want to do that. And then I will get these out to all your investment managers, new ones, get them all signed. You'll have a bunch of stuff to sign once they come back.
Yes. But,
so everybody will see your new investment policies.
Yeah.
Any motion to add de-risking into our?
Yeah. I'll move to add it.
De-risking verbiage.
I'll second that motion.
I'll try to Brian Booper in that regard.
Yes, sir.
Good job.
All those four?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye, sir.
Okay, now we should have a motion to adopt the revised
statement.
Yes, the entire statement, adopt that, and then that will need to be filed with the Division of Retirement, with the actuary, and with the city.
I'll move.
So moved.
What do you say?
All those four. All right, Lee.
Okie doke. Several things. I want to start to follow up on postings that we're required to make. And one is the actuary calculations required by 1.66 for the statutes. Have they been posted yet on our city website?
Yes.
Okay. And the administrative rule 60P calculations that I believe Rose provided to us?
Yes. We are all in compliance. I've uploaded everything.
Okay. Very good.
We did provide that letter. Alicia put it on letterhead, and it was sent from what she told me. So.
Okay. Financial disclosures. Have each of you filed your Form 1 financial disclosures? And they were passed July 1st, but the fines don't start until September 1st. So, and I'm
consistent. I do it every year by September 1st.
Okay, so we're in good shape with all our disclosures there.
Okay.
We have a pending disability claim, Sagermeyer. Mm-hmm. And under our, we're waiting for records from Chance. And typically they're pretty slow getting records out. The initial hearing date currently is September 14th. Under our rules, the board on its own action can extend an additional 90 days. I recommend that we do that. My motion today, extend the additional 90 days.
I'm sorry, Lee, I didn't hear you. What about the 14th?
The initial hearing date, Bernie, is September 14th under the rules. But also under the rules, we can extend, if necessary, an additional 90 days. And we haven't received all the records back yet, and Shands is particularly slow. Oftentimes you get the records out, so I recommend we extend the date to have the initial hearing an additional 90 days.
Okay.
I move we accept the council's recommendation that we extend the date to the initial hearing by 90 days.
I'll second that. All those for? All right.
Okay, now, the, I spoke to these folks last week. As you know, we are having a tax review done by Guy Smoller Law Firm out of Indianapolis. And I'm going to pass the cover letter out. It's, they're still preparing some charts and a very comprehensive study that they have done. And I want to pass this letter around. A couple of things I want to talk about. I want to direct your attention to the last paragraph on the, and this is a two-sided copy, the last paragraph on the front page. That specifically addresses the, as it notes, the variable benefit and contribution program. And I'll note also all the charts and the work that they had done for ordinances prior to that with compliance were in good shape. See, this recommends that we receive assurances, and I would suggest to be from the individuals who did it, that the program, as it says here, satisfies all the federal requirements, including but not limited to the definitely determinable benefit rules and the three ERISA vesting standards. They had not seen this type of a program before. Of course, we knew it was somewhat unique. And of course, one of those, I cited two, one was another state, one was Palm Beach, which they work for also. In any event, I talked to Mary Beth Brinkman and the actuary with their firm, and that's the bottom line there's concerns about.
So who do you seek assurance from?
Well, I would seek, and that's for the board to determine, but I would think we need to receive that from the individuals that recommended the program and prepared it.
Well, as far as the vesting standards, don't we comply with that since they've commingled the funds?
Well, that's, well, this is pre-ERISA vesting standards, and that's one of the issues that they're concerned about. I say it's for the board to decide, but I would think the assurances should come from the individuals that put off the program and drafted the documents.
And what warranties would we gain by those assurances?
Well, I think the first step, Barney, would be if the board directs to ask the city, since you contracted for the services, to ask them for assurances that it meets all the federal requirements, including specifically the ones that are stated here, and let them decide, you know, what they want to do to provide them. It may be file with the IRS for a favorable determination. I think we'll have to see what they come back with. I think it's incumbent upon the board to bring this to the attention of the city in the first instance. And I don't feel like the board ought to have to go to the expense of going through this process, given the fact
that was going to be my question, and shift the expense of the...
Yeah, the board's been left down. I spoke with these folks on Friday, and so this is as up to date as we can get. This is available, but the board was completely left out of this process,
right,
as we're all aware. And we suspected, we anticipated that there may be a problem, and there may or may not be, but we need, just as this says, assurance. And I don't think it ought to be the board's expense.
Can we ask you to draft a letter?
Yeah, however you would like to do it. Yeah, I don't know if it would be better coming from me or the chairman. And I know Ernie's been involved with this
for a while.
From the beginning.
So, no disrespect, but it's a lawyer leaving it open to interpretation, and then we're going to pass it back to a lawyer and ask them for their assurance of what, how they interpret what we call, you know, the federal requirements, and who's to say what the federal requirements are in full. So it's going to get into
a determination letter that you...
Well, they may decide, okay.
Because Jim's going to say, yeah, it's good.
Oh, well, yeah, but that... I don't think that would be satisfactory.
Right.
I'm not sure what we demand that he guarantees it. And do you have any recommendations of, you know, what are the federal requirements? I mean,
well, what would be, and I discussed it with Mary Beth, is apply for or send it to the IRS for a favorable interpretation.
Now, how do we go about that exercise? Does that mean that Ice Miller would do it?
No, I'm suggesting that the city and the folks they employ to do this
request a determination letter.
Right, so you remember when Mary Ann went down to that firm down in Miami or something, they came back with some bogus thoughts that it looked like it was legal. I mean, does that mean?
No, well, that meant nothing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think the last paragraph said it meant nothing.
Right. So, I mean, as you know, Ice Miller is one of the foremost firms in these matters, and it didn't surprise me, but when they said it's the first of this design that they've seen, you know, variations on a theme, but never
it's a case of first impression. I mean, it truly is.
Right. Right. And it's something that there's going to be a significant time involvement and contact with the IRS over this. And I believe people ought to be doing it, people who designed it. Correct.
Well, I'm just thinking how you go about it. I think your signature needs to be on it. And Arnie can't very well be on your letterhead. So should it be a resolution from this board signed by you and by Lee?
I'm not sure if Lee needs to be in this piece. I mean, we just use Lee as a middleman to go to Ice Miller, commission them, and get their opinion on it. And their opinion is that we need some more.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
I said, it's one lawyer telling us go to another lawyer and giving their, you know.
Well, I think that last paragraph sums it up exactly as it is. And, that's what we want. We want some assurance from them to
through IRS,
not
from Miami.
And the way you do that is through a determination letter that you file, or request a determination letter that you file. So I guess then would I be out of line to say if Lee could draft for you?
No, the appropriate. If you could help me write a letter, I'll sit with Alicia and then we will send it off from the board.
Yeah, and I think
from the board. Yeah,
really, and I think it's just as.
It's that simple.
Just as simple as basically providing a copy of this and the board recommending that they comply with the recommendation of the of council.
Well, you know, it doesn't say get a favorable determination letter, but what I would say is...
Well, they said assurance, so let's see what they come
And our surmise is that this means... But to get a favorable determination letter from the Internal Revenue Service with regard to the plan, and that's what I'm saying needs to be in this letter.
Yeah, well,
certainly the city has a significant interest in this given the fact that it's a qualification requirement, the city has...
I think they're blindly going like sheep, they're just listening to what was, you know, given to them and...
But really, the city doesn't, they're a tax-free entity.
Yeah, but what about the employees?
Oh, it's the employees, you know, that, and I agree totally, I mean, that's...
And our job's to look at the plan, not the employees.
Well, also, the fact, we don't pay tax on our investments in this fund, and many think it's because we're a public entity, and that's not the case. The reason we don't is that we've been deemed to be qualified by the IRS. So that could have a significant impact on the funding department.
On the fund and the employees in these past 5 years.
And really, when these plans are disqualified, they're not disqualified, from my recollection, from that day forward. They are disqualified all the way back.
Like you go back to 18.
Yeah, 13 when they implemented.
Yeah.
But if you really have a burden on employees...
Well, the benefits...
It's actually tax deferred.
The benefits of tax qualification are significant.
Right.
We're not paying tax on the earnings of the fund. The members of the plan are not paying every year income tax as the value of the accrued benefit increases.
So you say that actually would increase the city's contribution too, though?
Sure. And the before tax treatment.
It would increase the city's contribution that they would have to put in the plan, so.
Right.
You would think the city would be concerned about it.
No, they didn't decrease it. Do you know how much they pay in pension now? It's 100% bill of all those that are in the fund. Anyone that stayed in the variable, they're paying 100% of their pension.
Do we know how many employees that were?
Yes, 240, I think it is.
Okay.
That's why it's gone up, because like 270 bailed.
Yeah, right.
So, and we're not, I need to be clear, we're not alleging anything is wrong at this point.
Yeah.
But...
We don't know, but we want some IRS.
Sure, because of the very unique design.
Yeah, if these people can't determine the validity of it...
Well, I think they would. I think they would be happy to do a determination letter. That's what they're basically saying, is you need to get a determination letter. And what Lee is saying is the determination letter problem ought to be put on the people that designed this plan.
Right. So we as the board have to write a letter to the city recommending that that they seek assurance.
And I would add the line as we said, this board and have been out of the entire process.
Right.
From the get-go.
And, you know, I don't want to just keep going on this thing, but my recommendation is that the letter definitely be done, with Lee being a big player in it, in terms of, you know, what does assurance mean? You know, the assurance being that they acquire, make application for a determination letter.
Okay, so I don't think at this point, though, Bernie, we should tell them how to fix
what to do.
No, we as a board just ask the city to seek assurance.
Issue
from
to their attention and see
the
what matters.
Jim and Jen,
visitors.
Yeah.
And see what they come back with.
Yeah, just,
I
guess,
first step.
I'll sit with Alicia and we'll try to formulate. Just be assured.
Just give me a call.
Right, we'll run it by Lee and we'll send it out for each board member to review it. Remember, don't reply to all. And we'll send
that would be a default, okay, if they don't reply at all. I don't, you're saying we're going to share it with the board members.
I'm saying that you shouldn't, you know, give your input to everybody else.
I think for sunshine, I don't think
okay.
We should send it around.
Okay.
I think with this discussion.
Since we're just formulating that?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Do you have anything else before I ask you a question?
No.
All right, so I think you're aware that we're having a lot of problems with getting moved over to Wells Fargo.
Yes. my recommendation there, and I've seen emails, would be that the communication with Bank of New York, and the first step would be that we're going to report them to the regulator, and I think that they get them off that center. So it's amazing they're not providing the record.
So that letter, I think, needs to come from you.
Yeah, that's...
You agree with that one, right?
Yeah, that's... I think that'd be the first step.
All right.
And I don't agree, as you know, too, as I replied back, I understand Wells Fargo wanting, basically, they want us to indemnify them against loss for the information, and I'm not picking that up.
Right.
So they knew what they were getting into?
Right. They assumed the risk, right.
Well, they're just saying if they don't get accurate information, how can we hold them accountable for
yes,
the numbers?
Yes, if you would, I'd be happy to do that. Whether just I'll need to be a leecher provided with who our contact person has been there.
How bad is that, sir?
Well, just so you know, these are all the funds that Wells Fargo is saying, hey, you haven't given us accurate information on. When you look at it, it's probably, if you count it out, it's probably everything we have, all our money managers. And
what, they just won't give them data?
Right.
Let's see, pass it around, sorry. We just can't get the data, so Wells Fargo says, okay.
Yeah, they wouldn't give the data, and then Wells Fargo wanted us to, since they
didn't get the data,
Well, given all the problems that Alicia just had with BNY, I guess it's not a surprise that BNY.
Yeah, I just think, Lee, if you
have
could.
Doesn't have the data. It's pretty sad.
We obviously have no basis to know whether it's right, wrong, or you.
Right. So how long do we give them to provide accurate data before we go on over their head to...
Are we going immediately to a regulator? That was the impression that I got.
I mean, because it's
really hindering us.
They don't do it within, right. This is what, I mean, they yeah. To say 30 days or something.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
30 days seems better.
I mean, they should have the number.
So
we
need
this in
30 days, or we're going to go to the regulators.
Right, go to the regulators, yeah.
So, let's say, just have Alicia get the contact information, and I'll make that letter.
Yeah.
Boy. I find myself saying more and more, we've been doing this for over 37 years, and there's still new things come down the pike, and this is one of them.
We just don't want to give it up, that's all. Treat us like crap, but don't want to let us go.
Certainly not making it easy, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, I wonder if there's any damages actually incurred because of all of this, that, you know, we can't move money around. Are there losses because of it?
Well, I think she's been okay with Wells, to be able to do everything with Wells. It's
right.
Just that they don't have the backup data historically, I think is what it is. So.
Is it all the backup information? I mean, so
I
they have accurate
so.
Numbers
mean,
right now?
It's yeah. I think it's just... Yeah, I think it's just old data, like the... See, you have to remember, and this happened to all the banks, I'm pretty sure you had Mellon,
mm-hmm.
didn't you?
Yeah.
And so BNY bought Mellon, and when BNY bought the Mellon business, you're a part of the business, and I have a couple times, I still have one with BNY, the division you have up at FSU. All the business that BNY, or at least a lot of it that BNY bought from Mellon, they didn't want. And instead of just sort of saying, hey, we don't, you know, like, you know, smart people would be like, hey, we, you know, we're not going to take clients under this asset amount or something.
Right.
Instead, they just never serviced them. I mean, that's why you moved, because, and I have, up at FSU is the same problem. So BNY services their business really well.
Mm-hmm.
But the Mellon part that they bought, they don't, it's like they don't even know it exists. They don't even bother to service it. And this is probably just systemic of the bigger issue. But I think a letter would probably get them to find some people to get you accurate records and give you your stuff.
Right.
Because I'm sure it's all there. It's just they don't have, they, you know, they don't put any manpower into somebody going through the stuff and, you know, giving you accurate, well, accurate information, so.
All right. Has everybody seen the minutes?
Yep.
Any changes? Everything's okay? I got a motion to accept them?
I make a motion to accept the minutes as written.
Thanks. So the next thing is the school. Bernie, you said you want to go?
Yeah.
Anthony, I don't know if it's too short of notice for you to schedule something. All right, if you want to check on that real quick and get with Alicia. I mean, one way or the other, because... I mean, even you went to the firefighter thing, it probably covered about the same stuff, but...
There is one in Orlando in 1st of February. The same school.
Correct.
Yeah. Also, the division of retirement is having their fall conference November 2nd, 3rd, 4th. That's at the Radisson in Orlando. Most of what's covered in that program are applicable to general employee plans and trustees. It's not just for the use of the
What was it, November 1st through the 3rd?
2, 3, and 4. November 2, 3, and 4 at the Radisson Orlando. It's the one that's right on I-4 there. Lake Randall celebration.
Am I entitled to put into that one as well?
It's a new year, I guess. Yeah.
Be a little bit something to
something different, sure. So you get with Alicia.
All right. What do we call this now? This the one that you just referred to.
Division of Retirement.
The Division of Retirement. So that's the state. Yes. Something that the state puts on.
Right.
And what is the agenda like?
Their format typically they have two a year, as you know. Recent years has been made here. They do one in Tallahassee, jointly sponsored with Florida State, and then they do this one in the fall. It's typically either in the Orlando or the Tampa area. And the first day is a new trustee school. They call it. That's very basic. And then the next 2 days are regular programming with the topics that the speakers address.
And they address general employee plan, firefighter plans, police.
Most of it, Bernie, is applicable to general employee plans as well as fire plans.
Okay.
All right, so the last thing I have is Foster and Foster would like to do an experience study, which they do every so many years, and we're due for one. It would cost the board $15,000.
I'm sorry, what kind of study?
It's an experience study.
How good our experience is with
it deals with a lot of things. And Rose, you probably could explain, like, to the T what an experience study really brings to the actuary.
So what they're going to do is they're going to take your assumptions, so the assumptions that they made for how many people are going to retire in a given year, how many people are going to go out on disability, all your factors, what inflation is, all the factors that they use to do your calculations, and they're going to say, do they actually match the experience that you've had over the last 5 years? Or are you off? And the good thing about it is, well, I don't know, there's been bad, like, because if you have favorable experience, then it's going to help. If you have unfavorable, like if you had more people retire than you expected, it can And then it'll change their assumptions, how they'll come to you with recommendations saying, okay, we're a little bit off here, so not a big deal, we'll keep the assumption the way it is. But here, we were way more off than we thought, we recommend that maybe you change this assumption. So it's assumptions for disability, how many people retire, inflation.
And obviously, the bottom line to it is your funding level, I mean, how much you're putting to the plan.
So since the last one, we've had these raises that have gone out, we've had some people who left early. So a lot of the algorithms that they form for their crystal ball to understand it have changed on them. So that's why every so many years they do an experience study, which really means they have to go way back and dig out a lot of records. I mean, it's a lot of crunching for them to do it.
Well, this could potentially be a good time to do it because, as we've discussed before, we're mandated to use the same mortality tables and assumptions that FRS uses beginning with this 10-1-16 valuation, which is, in most cases, going to increase the cost, and maybe something there that could offset that to some extent.
I make a motion that we ask Foster and Foster to proceed with an experience study.
Okay. All right. And they'll bring that at the November meeting. Just so you're all aware that because of our not great returns, City Council has approved all members that are in the variable defined rate are now going to be going forward and paying 5% instead of 3%, kicking in the 2% to the employees. But on a good side, they're expecting to give everybody a 2% raise, so it might not hurt them. But there are no guarantees so far until October 1st. But there is a guarantee that the employees that remain in the defined variable rate will be paying 5% now, which is the maximum. They gave a 3% to 5% with a guarantee of a 1% multiplier. So they're at the upper limits. They'll be paying the 5% and only guaranteed a 1% return. So this would, for someone like my age, when I'm only sticking around for a couple more years, it's a solid thing for me because at least, okay, I'm only giving up a couple more percent, but I have a fixed number when I retire. You know, that I have a fixed number. But for anyone who's got, you know, several years left, I mean, it's not a great thing for them. But, you know, playing the stock market, as we all should be aware, I mean, we're way beyond the 7 years when the cycle's supposed to change, but everything's unprecedented with the stock market now.
Let's wait until November.
We'll see.
But we do have in our records now.
Going forward, we're looking for a 60-40, and
which shows we're concerned.
Forward thinking. Does anybody have anything else?
Yes, Alicia and I will need an okay from the board for us to go to the October school.
Can you just go to one?
I did. This one I can be certified in.
Is already a third one? September.
No.
September.
If I start now.
Oh, start now. Yeah. Okay.
So I would need the okay for that from you guys.
You mean the September school?
For this one coming up.
You mentioned October, September is 25th.
We need a motion.
I'd make a motion that staff, specifically Alicia and Jessica,
attend the
winter school, the winter trustee school sponsored by FPPTS. One second.
All right, all this work.
All right.
So I make reservations for yourselves, include Bernie, please. And Anthony will get back with you, what do you think, within a week?
Okay. All
right. I mean, if you can't make it, you can't make it, but I mean, if you want to get in there soon to get a reservation, otherwise, like Bernie, they'll shove you up the road a little bit.
We need to make a motion for me to go to that division of retirement thing. So if you could proceed with whatever is necessary for me to attend the Division of Retirement in Orlando?
Yes.
Coming up in November. Thank you, Matt.
Right.
When is our next meeting? November.
Next meeting's in November, I think.
I show November 14th.
There you go, see? You're quicker than me.
And I'll be happy.
Oh, every once in a while.
And I'll be happy to give a report on what I gleaned from the Division of Retirement.
Yeah, it was worth telling, huh? Versus, well, if nobody has anything else, let's adjourn.
I make a motion.